Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to be looking at the mobilisation of the Indian Army during the Second World War and the transition from the Indian Army from being a kind of a sepoy force designed to carry out whatever needs the British Raj had in India and the rest of Southeast Asia, to being a national army that was dedicated to pursuing Indian national goals. And in that process, in that transition from being essentially previously a mercenary force to being a force that was embedded in wider notions of Indian nationhood, this was a powerful force in the transition towards independence by 1947, and a powerful kind of mentality shift on behalf of the Indian Army, and one of the kind of the key ingredients that bind Indian nationhood together. So today I'm going to be reading from Srinath Raghavan's India's War. If you listen to this podcast fairly frequently, you'll know that we've looked at this book, it's probably last year now, but it's a really insightful guide to the development of India's war machine. And Srinath Raghavan writes, in March 1943, the chief of the general staff of the Indian Army wrote a candid letter to the army commanders. Prior to the war, he observed, the Indian Army was a mercenary army with its morale and loyalty based on four factors. First, recruitment was confined to classes, long-standing martial and professional traditions, which have long been centred on loyalty to the Sarkar and to the King Emperor. Second, the army was officered all but exclusively by experienced British officers who could command the respect and affection of these classes. Third, pay and conditions of service contrasted favourably with opportunities in civilian employment. Finally, the size of the army was small enough to ensure competition for vacancies. In almost all these respects, he noted, the situation had now radically changed. So this is the case. So it was a relatively small mercenary force which paid well, which was staffed almost exclusively by white British officers, and there was prestige attached to it, and there was competition for positions. The war obviously changes all these factors. In October 1939, the size of the Indian Army was 194,373 troops, and at the end of the war, it's nearly 10 times, it's over 10 times that size. It is at 2,065,554 troops. During that time, the Indian Air Force was one squadron of 285 officers and men to nine squadrons of 29,201 officers and men. The Royal Indian Navy went from 1,846 men to 30,748. And this included an increase in the size of warships. The expansion, which really was a tenfold increase in the size of India's military capacity, was, if you read Forgotten Armies and Forgotten Wars by Bailey and Harper, results in an industrial revolution in India. Not that India was deindustrialized prior to the Second World War, but during the war, an explosion in manufacturing, metallurgy, rail building, ship building, and electronics for aircraft, or electrics for aircraft anyway, and other such industries radically transforms the industrial map of India. So you have this tenfold increase in military capacity, and some of the kind of the fundamentals upon which Raj military power was based on are set aside. So the Raj sought to control and manage this expansion in ways that would not finally undermine British rule after the war, because even in 1945 the British believed that it would be possible to stay on in India, perhaps under slightly different circumstances, but they believed that would be possible. And the wartime growth of the army falls into basically three phases. In the first 8 months of the war, it's relatively slow expansion, but you could say the same for a great many countries that don't immediately face occupation. 50,000 troops were added to the pre-war number, and this includes Indian territorial battalions, which are raised really for internal security. The British and even the Congress can't rely on India not to erupt into some sort of civil disorder during the war. This very slow start is really due to kind of a lack of organisation. There's no previously thought-out plan. As we've seen when looking at India before, partly due to kind of British equivocation in the 1930s, a lack of certainty about what to do about possible wartime threats in Asia, and also to do with the way in which Lord Linlithgow unilaterally declared war on Germany on the behalf of India. There was a kind of a great deal of chaos and indecision when it comes to actually raising battalions. A plan had very quickly been thrown together in in midway through 1939, but it had never really been kind of explored or formally adopted. And this was probably a good thing, because the proposed plan was actually far more modest and saw far weaker recruitment than that which actually occurred. The idea of raising one division every 6 months was forgettable and useless that it was quickly abandoned. One significant problem was that even when the war started, there was no clear directive from the British government on possible troop demands from India. So the British government weren't sending clear messages saying that they would need troops in Egypt, even though obviously they do. The only thing that was clear was that there was a timetable of modernisation that had been drawn up for the Indian Army that would now have to be completely and utterly got rid of, eradicated, because the wartime conditions precluded that. So, after a long period of procrastinating, a general staff in India take it upon themselves to draw up a major expansion plan in May 1940. So, Raghavan writes, "This marked the beginnings of a second stage of wartime enlargement. The plan had been advanced in the light of London's desire to offer a guarantee to Afghanistan against Russian attack. Now, I did a podcast on this last year. You can go back through and find out about Britain's wartime planning for Afghanistan. However, although the General Staff knew that their operational plan would not be approved by the British Chiefs of Staff on account of the demands it would place on British forces, it was felt that the time was propitious for undertaking an expansion of the army. For one thing, the General Staff believed that India would be called upon at some point to contribute to the defence of the Middle East. For another, the fall of the Low Countries and the invasion of France had made Indian opinion more sympathetic to the Allied cause than at any time since the start of the war. Even the Congress was expressing its willingness to cooperate in the war effort. In this context, the Indian government felt that the Russian menace and India's apprehensions regarding it provide a most favourable opportunity for initiating these efforts with minimal political opposition. So, India's General Staff suggested that the army raise 18 infantry battalions and 3 field artillery regiments and supporting service such as engineers and signals and organisational and logistics units for 6 army divisions. The divisions in question would be available for deployment elsewhere, such as Afghanistan, for example. If India raised an equal number of units to replace those that might be sent away, then this situation would, this policy would probably work. The chiefs of staff in India sought White Horse permission immediately to get started on this. Implementing these measures, the staff basically told the British, would absorb the entire energies of India, of the Indian defence establishment, of the Indian defence industries, for at least a year, and that would be as much as India could actually contribute to the war effort, would be preparing to become a kind of a military superpower in Asia. The Secretary of State for India was keen to give the green light. The plan, he advised the War Cabinet, was a valuable step forward towards enabling India to pull her weight yet more fully in the present struggle. So, Raghavan writes, weeks after the plan was approved in London, Italy entered the war. Linlithgow promptly offered to dispatch to the Middle East 18 infantry brigades, 1 motorised cavalry brigade, and 1 field artillery regiment, as well as supporting units, in all nearly 90,000 men. So that would be roughly 50% of the existing Indian army. The troops would be sent out in phases from July 1940 to April 1941. The Chiefs of Staff welcomed the Viceroy's offer, but pointedly added that these forces from India should not be regarded as the total which will eventually be required from her. Indeed, India would thenceforth have to stand ready to meet an insatiable demand for troops. So, this was a war that was fought on, obviously, a mass scale, and the ability of countries such as the Soviet Union or the United States to raise ever greater number of troops placed those countries on the winning side. And it was the Indian Army and its ability to produce huge amounts of manpower were one of the things that bought Britain a place at the top table of negotiations during the war. It's Britain's hidden sort of superpower weapon. So in 1940, in August, the Indian government offered 4 infantry divisions and 1 armoured division for overseas deployment, as long as the British agreed to equip them.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank.
LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
In September, the British had accepted the offer and they were deployed to Malaya. One was deployed to Malaya and the other three to Iraq to protect rubber and oil, respectively. But instead of an armoured division, India was asked to send out an armoured cavalry brigade and an additional infantry division. In the event, it was agreed that India would raise 4 new infantry divisions by December 1941 and a fifth by mid-1942. Now, by late 1940, anxieties about the Soviet threat to Afghanistan had kind of gone into decline. People no longer saw that as being a realistic fear. However, Japan's seizure of French Indochina started to present the real danger to Britain's position in Asia. By the end of March 1941, the General Staff came up with the 1941 Defence of India Plan. This plan had two phases. The first would entail a purely defensive operations along the northwest frontier and an advance into Afghanistan, which, again, the plan seems to be kind of fundamentally out of date at this point. And the second phase could be undertaken only if there was extra support from the British, from Great Britain. The plan envisaged defensive operations on the Indo-Afghan border, and that's it. So there was kind of a real disconnect between the strategic realities and that Japan is the threat and the General Staff's perception that Afghanistan is still the weakest part of India's defences and that the Soviet Union might still possibly attack. So what we see is this increase in manpower, but all sorts of strategic misconceptions. It's notable that Malaya, when it is attacked by Japan, is poorly defended, and the Japanese, even though the British and Australian and Indian troops put up a fierce fight, they are there are not enough of them, and the Japanese push them very quickly down the Malay Peninsula towards Johor and towards Singapore. From April 1940 to December 1941 was the time of the phase of huge recruitment. So almost 900,000 troops are under Indian colours by December 1941. Monthly recruitment exceeded 50,000 at its height. And technical personnel, which were basically non-existent before the war, were 9,000 a month. So these are kind of engineers, mechanics, that sort of thing, signalers. From the princely Indian states, there were there was an increase in recruitment. The princely states had previously managed to largely avoid service in the Indian Army, but they were used to release basically units of regular troops for overseas duties at first. So princely state troops were used to for kind of internal purposes, and then finally they themselves were deployed overseas. By August 1941, there were 17 units from princely states serving in Egypt, East Africa, Iraq and Malaya. Places such as Nepal, for example, the Maharaja of Nepal loaned 8 battalions of his army for duties in India. So the changing course of the war made India, basically placed the burden of further commitments on India. So on the 22nd of June 1941, when Germany attacked the Soviet Union, with Russia now on the Allied side, Afghanistan could finally be dropped as a strategic concern, which only gave the British another 6 months until an attack on Malaya, which comes on the day of Pearl Harbor in December 1941. London and New Delhi could focus their efforts really on the Middle East at this point, as the Germans pushed towards the Caucasus, and as the during the Operation Barbarossa, and as the Germans pushed the British back in North Africa and brought about internal subversion in Iraq, Indian troops were relied upon to control Iraq and Iran particularly. In 1942, at the beginning of 1942, 264,000 Indian troops were serving overseas, including 91,000 in Iraq, 20,000 in the Middle East, 56,000 in Malaya, and 20,000 in Burma. 6 weeks before Operation Barbarossa began, the Indian government had been considering its plans for 1942. The government in Delhi told the British that if it's wanted, that if India's demands for equipment and personnel were met, India would be ready by the latter half of 1942 to provide an overseas deployment for 4 more infantry divisions and 1 armoured division. These troops were currently deployed only for India's defence. As previously, these would be made available only if India could plan for their prompt replacement. So internal defences and internal the keeping of internal order could only, those troops could only be moved if they could be promptly replaced. So the raising of 5 divisions would, and including an armoured division with supporting troops, required India to recruit another 600,000 soldiers. But the wild card into all of this is, of course, Japan's entry into the war in December 1941, which threw the plan into chaos, and meant that all of a sudden the Indian government had to improvise with recruitment again. However, that said, at the end of 1942, the Indian Army is at 1.5 million strong, and the Indian states' forces and British units in India added up to another 170,000 troops. So by December 1941, the government in Delhi was getting ready for further expansion up to 1943. The General Staff had planned for a further infantry division, a parachute division, a heavy armoured brigade. And on top of this, they wanted to raise 5 field artillery regiments, 7 anti-tank regiments and 10 anti-aircraft regiments, as well as new administrative and logistics units. So it's those sorts of things, adjutant generals' corps and quartermasters' corps, and logistics corps and that kind of thing. Armies can't function without them. It's all very well having frontline troops, but if you don't have an infrastructure to equip them and feed them, it's all going to go extremely badly wrong. The plan for 1943 included proposed another quarter of a million soldiers. But by 1943, it was becoming clear that the quality manpower, especially technical skill, was now at a premium in India. So Raghavan writes, further, the performance of Indian units on the front line underscored various deficiencies in training. So in the summer of 1943, two infantry divisions were converted into training divisions, an unprecedented experiment for the Indian Army. Although another 280,000 men were recruited in 1943, it was evident to the Indian government that the peak of recruitment had passed. So the army had swelled to its maximum size that it could possibly train and prepare for a complex technological war. So, as I said at the start, these phases of wartime enlargement began to fundamentally change the nature of the Indian Army. And we'll explore this in a subsequent podcast, because I think we're going to focus a bit more on India now. We've been a bit remiss on that one. But as the army grows bigger, it tends to dilute the previous principles that the army was based on, the previous logic that the army was based on, and instead entirely new individuals and who had previously never served in the army and never considered serving in the army came into military service, and the role of the army itself is based around defending India. It's obviously about fighting the wars of the British Empire overseas, but there's a profound role in defending India itself from invasion. And this means that by the end of the war, the Indian Army has transitioned into something different. The Indian Army has transitioned into, as all armies during the Second World War did, tools of kind of national self-determination and national self-identity and identification. And that meant that the Indian Army, when in 1946, it essentially goes on strike. It refuses to be deployed overseas any longer in the service of the British. It's the Indian Army that decides, really, when the Raj is over. But that's a slightly different story for another time. Anyway, thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.